Well, thank you, Joey. It's a pleasure to come here and see some of the familiar faces, Anne, and that delightful scene that we just heard, and Julie Bonzer, and the inevitable Jack, and whenever I run into Jack, it's usually with a feeling of mixed pain and pleasure. It's always wonderful to see an old friend, but you should know that Jack and I are members of a club, which meets every other Wednesday night at various homes. And we meet in dark basements, and we play with 52 pieces of plastic. Jack is one of the most adept players in our club. So I usually associate encounters with Jack with the loss of anywhere from $10 to $20. Jack, it's good to be with you again. I brought a picture to show you. It's a picture that any of us might encounter sometime on a vacation going west. It's a beautiful picture of the Rocky Mountains in western Montana, where the Great Plains meet the Front Range of the Rockies. And you can see the golden grain of the plain in the foreground, and you can see the snow-capped Front Range of the Rockies in the background. And there's this the kind of picture that one could encounter almost anywhere out west, but there's one striking difference. In the foreground of this picture is a man-made object that's kind of carved out of the Great Plains. It's hard to tell what it is as you approach it. You can see a couple of utility poles sticking out of the prairie. You can see some odd-looking implements that look a little bit like tubas that are planted in the prairie soil. There's a barbed wire fence enclosing something, and there's a huge slab of concrete. And as you drive by, you might think this is possibly a small electrical power substation, or maybe a very small sewer treatment plant or something like that, because there's no sign on it that tells you what it is. The only sign that's on the fence is a warning sign saying, danger, do not enter this installation without permission of the commander, use of deadly force authorized. That's code language for saying that this innocent-looking hole in the ground contains an implement of war. The piece of concrete that you see, the slab of concrete that is visible in the picture, is a 120-ton lid, concrete lid, for an underground silo. Silo is about 100 feet deep, and poised in that silo is a missile, a intercontinental ballistic missile that's about 70 feet long, and in its nose is a warhead, a nuclear warhead, which has the destructive power of 1.2 million tons of TNT, which is approximately 100 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed the city of Hiroshima in 1945. This missile is aimed. It's ready to launch. It can be launched within 31 seconds of notice. It's launched by a distant launch control center about 17 miles away. That's connected to the missile silo by an underground cable. And in the nose of the warhead, along with the actual destructive package, is a computer program which aims this missile at one of several targets on the other side of the world. One of those targets is very likely to be a major city in the Soviet Union. If this missile silo were aimed at Moscow, for example, or Leningrad, it is fully capable of killing at least 6 million people instantly, or in a matter of days, the effects of that one blast. And 6 million people is approximately the number of people who were killed in the Holocaust, in World War II. So this single ICBM can do what it took Nazi Germany the better part of 6 or 7 years to do. This nuclear missile is not a one-of-a-kind, not a one-time thing. It's one of 1,000. 1,000 nuclear missiles that are underneath the soil of 7 western Great Plains states. This one happens to be in Montana. Others are in Wyoming, Nebraska, Colorado, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Missouri. They're part of our land-based intercontinental ballistic missile system, which is in turn a part of the larger panoply of U.S. nuclear weapons that are also in submarines and on airplanes aimed at the Soviet Union. They, of course, have a comparable number aimed at us. What is it like to live next to a nuclear missile silo? Well, I want to read you something from this book to tell us what it's like. Very short passage about a family in Wyoming that has lived for many years with a nuclear missile in its backyard. The Wepners have 3 children, Soder and McNiss. Both mothers say the hardest part of living with a missile in the back 40 has been explaining it to the kids. There comes a time, usually when they are still quite young, says Mary Wepner, when they want to know what it's all about. Recently, Juan McNiff, 10, asked the difficult questions. She came to me and said, "Mommy, I don't want to die," says Beth McNiff. When you hear that, it breaks your heart. You wonder, why should a child have to think about nuclear war? On the other hand, growing up in Ground Zero is not like growing up someplace else. We tell them that at least we won't be around for the aftermath. That's America, 1990. I believe, and the people who I work with believe that the story of the nuclear missile silos is an important part of the American story. Not just the nuclear missile silos, but our entire connection with the business of preparing for nuclear war, for being prepared to essentially wipe out civilization as we know it. It's no news to anybody in this room that we are engaged in a nuclear arms race. Everybody understands that intellectually. Everybody knows, as a theoretical thing, that the arms race is very, very dangerous, and that the arms race really is without precedent in history, and that it could, if worse comes to worse, it could cause the death of hundreds and hundreds of millions of people. But that is kind of an intellectual, theoretical understanding. And what I try to do as a journalist primarily, but also as an educator, is try to translate that abstract knowledge into real gut feeling, so that we Americans understand, not just in our heads, but also in our gut and in our heart, what it means to be people who are preparing for the possible end of the earth as we know it. And I have a strong feeling that we need to confront that fact. Just as in the 1930s or early 1940s, the German people needed to confront the fact that they were engaged in a Holocaust too. Many Germans, most Germans after the war, could truthfully say they had no idea what was being done in those camps across the tracks. Nobody ever told them, and it was a total shock to them to discover that 6 million people had been slaughtered in their name. And I take them at their word, because the German people did not know. They made it their business not to know what was going on. I believe that Americans should not be in that same position. We need to know what's going on. We need to have an emotional understanding. We need to confront that reality and then do what we feel we need to do. So that's sort of the business that I'm in. I'm educating, telling a story about what's going on in America, in these holes in the grounds, and all the other ways in which we interconnect with the preparation for nuclear war, including right here in Madison, Wisconsin, through the University of Wisconsin research, for example, and through other kinds of things that we do in our daily lives, which in a way give consent to the preparation of nuclear holocaust. That's what I do. And for many years, I and people I work with have been focusing on nuclear missile silos, not because they are particularly bad, but because they are accessible. They're much more accessible to us than our other forms of nuclear warfighting capability. And also they are symbolic of the whole nuclear weapons apparatus. So we approach the nuclear weapons silos as symbols rather than as being the problem in themselves. Over the years we have, working with people in the missile silo states, we have gone out and mapped the nuclear missile silos and organized vigils that enable people to go out and see the nuclear missile silos for themselves and contemplate the reality of what nuclear war is all about. One of the states that we have been very active in is the state of Missouri. And our Missouri is known as the Show Me State. So we did a little pamphlet called Show Me. And what we show is the nuclear missile silos, 150 of them, in this one state of Missouri. This map is put together by citizens working voluntarily without pay, driving around for hundreds of miles, physically locating the precise spot of all the 150 nuclear missile launch sites in the state of Missouri. And having done this map, they then helped to publicize the existence of the silos, organize retreats, vigils, encampments, where people can go and get face-to-face with a 1.2 megaton missile silo. Each one of these nuclear silos have a name. Now the Air Force gives them rather nondescript names like A1, B2, K11. The people who do these maps, they believe that more creative and meaningful names are appropriate. So they for one thing, they name them after people in Missouri who were responsible for bringing them. There's the Stuart Symington missile. There's the Thomas Eagleton missile. There's one named for Ike Skelton, who is the present congressman whose district covers all this area between Kansas City and Jefferson City. And other missiles are named for Auschwitz and Dachau and other places familiar to the old Holocaust, and so on and so forth. And each one of the missiles, in addition to having a name, an Air Force designation, and a peacemaker's name, has a precise direction on how you reach this particular missile. Just as though you might give directions for your house. So you can spot the missile in red on the map, and then you can find out exactly how to reach it. I'm going to tell you how to reach missile silo K-8. K-8 is near the town of Rich Hill, Missouri. And so that's how it got its name. It's called For the Rich Missile. K-8 from the United States, U.S. Highway 71 at Rich Hill, go 0.6 miles east on County Road B. Missile is on the right. If you follow those directions, you will get to missile silo K-8. On August 15th of 1988, about a year and a half ago, I followed those directions. Early in the morning, I was one of three people in an automobile. And we drove from Kansas City down U.S. Highway 71. We got to Rich Hill. We turned left on Highway, County Highway B. We went 0.6 mile, and there, sure enough, was the For the Rich missile. There were four of us in the car. One was a housewife from Kansas City who served as our driver. The second was a woman from Chicago who had flown to Kansas City. She's active in the peace movement in Chicago. And she was there as an observer. And the other two people were me and a young woman from Milwaukee named Kate Willems. Kate Willems works in the Casa Maria Catholic Worker House in Milwaukee. And that's a place that serves the poor, poor women, poor children, people who are homeless. That's her job, is working for justice in Milwaukee. Kate Willems also believes in working for peace. And so she came down with me for the purpose of entering that nuclear missile site, which we did. I was dressed in a clown suit, of all things. And we went, we took a bolt cutter, and we cut the bolt, and we went in there, and we joyously spread seeds, cast seeds, all over this barren soil of missile silo K-8. Why were we planting seeds? We were planting seeds in order to symbolically say that this land, this little two-acre patch near Rich Hill, Missouri, needs to be used for a different purpose. It needs to be used not to kill 6 million people who we don't even know on the other side of the world. It needs to be used to feed the hungry. It needs to be used for people for peaceful purposes in the middle of the breadbasket of North America. So we spread our seeds. We also hung up banners. And since I was dressed in a clown suit, we also tied balloons to these deadly instruments which served as navigational guides for the nuclear missile silo. And Kate played a recorder, and I danced a jig in my clown suit, and she played a recorder. Why did we do that? Why were we sort of making fun of a terribly deadly thing like a nuclear missile? We did it because we felt that we needed to do as the Quakers say when they talk of speaking the truth to power. We wanted to do what the ancient court jester did in the time of the court of King Arthur in the Middle Ages, where the jester, by saying something in a humorous way, was permitted by the emperor to say unwelcome truth, because he said them with humor and he said them in a way that did not directly accuse anybody of anything. And so we wanted to use humor in this way to speak the truth that the American people were giving their consent to essentially a genocidal policy. Well, we thought that we were making a point, and indeed we did, because when we entered that nuclear missile silo, we triggered an alarm which automatically warned the Air Force that something was wrong. We were part of a rather large group who called ourselves the Missouri Peace Planners. Katie and I were just two people who went into about 10 different nuclear missile silos. There were 15 people in all who entered these silos against the wall to make the same point that Kate Williams and I were making. We were arrested in short order, and in due course we were prosecuted, tried, and all 15 of us have been convicted. In my case, I was charged with just a single count of breaking the federal trespass law, which carries a maximum penalty of 6 months in prison and a $500 fine. Others in our group had gone and done the same thing several times, and so they were given several counts. And so about half of our group are still in prison, including, for example, a 64-year-old grandmother named Dorothy Eber from Chicago, who's serving 26 months in prison, partly for having gone into several nuclear missile silos, but also for contempt of court, for having refused to tell the prosecutor and the judge who some of her co-conspirators were. There's a Catholic priest named Jerry Zawada from Milwaukee who was given a 2-year prison term. Kathy and Dorothy Eber and Jerry Zawada are still in. Another one was my colleague Bonnie Erfer, who works with me in Newquash. Bonnie Erfer received a 19-month prison term. Bonnie is currently out, in a way, living in a halfway house here in Madison, but she's still under her prison term. And so 15 of us went to prison. I was convicted last January, just about a year ago, and given the maximum 6 months, which was the most that I could get. I entered the federal prison system the day after Easter on March 27th, spent a little time at first in a filthy little county jail outside of Kansas City, and then was transferred to a whole series of federal prisons. I was in a total of 9 different jails and prisons over a 6-month period. And so I got a good tour, courtesy of Uncle Sam, the Bureau of Prisons. And others had similar experiences. And I want to tell you just a little bit about our experiences in prison. And then I'm going to open this up for questions and answers. While we were in prison, we were able to correspond, that is, those 15 of us were able to correspond with each other through a lawyer in Kansas City who served as our lawyer and also our helper. And by working through her, we were able to write and illustrate and edit and publish a book. Rather unusual thing, but we did this book. 15 of us, with help from other people who had formerly been in prison, a book about what it's like to be a prisoner of conscience in the American prison system today. A book that we came to call Prisoners on Purpose. Prisoners on Purpose is the story of what it's like if when you follow your conscience, break the law, and come to the time when you have to go to prison. We discovered a number of things that it should not be too surprising. Number one, the prison system is a terribly violent place. It's not violent in the sense that guards come into your cell and work you over with a rubber hose or punch you in the nose. There's not that kind of violence. It's a kind of a static, emotional violence. I'm going to read you one of the prison stories that tells what that violence is like for people who are in prison. This one is by Bonnie Erker, my colleague at Newport, written from the Alderson Federal Women's Prison, Alderson, West Virginia. It's a brief story. It's only 9 paragraphs long, but it makes the point about violence. It's called Mother's Day. And here's the story. The children start arriving at 8 or so in the morning at Alderson Federal Correctional Institution. This is the only day in the year they can spend alone with their mothers on the prison grounds. Administrators, employees, and guards all participate, proud of their graciousness, their kindness, their sensitivity on this one day. The prison provides free ice cream, cotton candy, games, balls, balloons, baby animals to look at, face paint. It's like going to the fair. Many of these children don't see their mothers often. Once every 2 years is not unusual. Some of the younger ones don't even know who their mothers are because surrogate parents are not allowed in on Mother's Day. The child may be left to enjoy the day with a stranger. Before the children are allowed in, each is patted down, even the infants. Diapers are removed in the search for drugs and other contraband. There are some sad scenes. A young girl looks in bewilderment, trying to figure out which woman is her mommy. A little boy screams for his mommy, unaware that she is the one holding his hand. More anguish at the end of the day, once children and parents are reacquainted, when the time comes to leave. Mom is distraught, and the kids wonder why it is that she gets to stay in such a nice place while they have to go. Such cruelties are perpetrated to make prison administrators look and feel good, thinking they have done their part to preserve the family. They are sorely mistaken. There's no reason why mothers in prison should not be with their young children all the time. To allow just one day a year is a travesty. As the women made the most of their fleeting moments of motherhood, and as the administration flaunted its compassion, the children absorbed another dose of psychological punishment in their battered lives, and a wonderful day was had by all. That is prison for mothers at the Alderson Women's Prison in West Virginia. Prison is a terribly abusive, terribly wasteful way for people to live. I encountered that myself in the various prisons I was in, particularly And what I learned about the people who are in for drug offenses, for example. We all know about the war of drugs, and we all know that the policy of the Bush administration, as well as the Tommy Thompson administration, essentially, is to throw the book at drug dealers, send them off to prison for a long period of time. I met a lot of those drug dealers when I was at Sandstone Prison, when I was at Leavenworth, and when I was at Terre Haute, and at other penitentiaries and prisons. And I came across with a profound feeling that that we are not only not addressing the real drug problem, but that we are erecting fictitious enemies, basically little tiny people who are dealing in drugs in order to satisfy their own addiction to drugs. And that the big people who really are in drugs in a big way are not just the so-called illegal drugs, but also the drugs of tobacco and alcohol, which cause far more distress than the illegal drugs. Those are the ones who are going free. And that as a result, we are creating a whole embittered society out of our efforts to deal with the real problem of drug abuse. So prison is not the place for I'd say 85 or 90% of the people who are there today. This fast-growing, huge federal, state, county prison system. It's an abomination. It's a terrible waste of our tax money and of our human resources. It's not the way to fight the real problem of drug abuse. At the same time, I and my other prisoners on purpose made the discovery that prison is the right place. Prison is eminently the right place for some people, namely us. We felt good about being in prison. We really did. We felt that we were there for a purpose. And the purpose of our being there was to make a statement about the laws of the United States, which are laws which sanctify nuclear annihilation. And we felt that while it's all very well to oppose those laws, and we should oppose them in the world of politics, the everyday world of electoral politics, there are certain kinds of laws, and the laws that perpetuate nuclear warfare are one of them, which deserve to be disobeyed. And we disobeyed those laws deliberately, joyously, and provocatively, for the same reason that the laws that perpetuated British rule in India were disobeyed joyously and nonviolently by Gandhi and those who followed Gandhi. And for the same reason that the Jim Crow laws of the Old South were disobeyed deliberately and nonviolently and peacefully by Martin Luther King and many, many others in order to make the point that those laws are bad and that we should use the prison experience as a way of dramatizing the badness of those laws. And so we found that in our case, being in prison for a good reason, being in prison for the right reason, makes it a very tolerable experience, provided certain other things are present. Number one, you have to be in reasonably good health. If you are in ill health, prison is not the place to be. You should do your peace work outside of prison. Number two, you need to have a community of support. You cannot do it all by yourself. Nobody is that strong. You have to have people at home who are supporting you, and I did. And you've got to have people on the outside who are writing to you and who are keeping up your spirits. You have to be part of the community. And that's important. And that's a situation that most prisoners do not enjoy. They are in there by themselves rather than as part of a support network. And number three, the third condition, is it does come a point, you know, when prison will break you down. Even if you are a Mahatma Gandhi, if you serve 5-6 years in prison, your spirit is going to be broken. And so a prison should not be something that one blithely gets into and has to confront a long term. Anything more than about a year, I think, is not a good thing to do, and that one should not expose himself to that. A final point, and then we'll get into the question and answer. So one of the people that I got to know quite well in the Sandstone Prison up in Minnesota was a man named Joe Gump. He was about of my age, in his early 60s. And Joe Gump was in for a long term for having gone into a nuclear missile silo in Missouri. And he didn't just stand there and tie balloons on the instruments as I did. He took a hammer and using the old phrase from Isaiah, beating swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks, he beat on the instruments in that nuclear missile silo with his hammer. He caused some damage, about $3,500 worth of damage. And he also poured blood in order to make the point that these instruments of death do cause bloodshed. And so he was given a long term, and he was at Sandstone, and I joined him there. And he and I used to do for a while he was still free in the compound, we used to do our walks every afternoon around the track, prison track at Sandstone. And we decided that we were there for a good reason, and that that many other people ought to be there in prison too. And he said, Sam, when you get out, I want you to go places. He didn't mention the prayer you were telling me to go. He said, let's get some company in here. We need to get more people in there. And he said, I want you to work on the older ones. Don't talk to people who have young kids. If you've got kids, you shouldn't be in prison. You should be home raising your children. If you're working and you are in the stage of your life where you need income, maybe to support elderly relatives or just simply in order to feed the family, prison is not a place to be. There are young people, there are young mothers and fathers in prison. But he said, Sam, I want you to work on the old folks. I want you to work on people who are our generation. People who want a little bit more meaning in their lives. Instead of approaching retirement, they're tired of working at the post office. They want something that's got some ups and downs, a chance to travel. And especially they are people of the generation who caused this problem. It was we who did that. You know, we were the ones who were alive in the 50s and were part of the voting generation. We were the ones who grooved on John F. Kennedy and his love affair with missiles. These missiles were put in by John F. Kennedy. Don't blame Nixon, don't blame Reagan. Blame John F. Kennedy and McNamara. They put the missiles in because they were a cheaper way to kill people. Cheaper than airplanes, cheaper than submarines. And you and I, of my age, we were part of that liberal constituency that applauded this kind of macho policy toward the world. And so maybe we need to make amends. This is still sort of Joe Gunn talking. And so get the old people in. Those who have passed their prime and now can do a little constructive work, going into the missile silos. And we even thought of a name for the organization. We call it Old Crocs for Peace. Well, I brought myself a little sign-up sheet. Anybody wants to sign up for Old Crocs for Peace, just see me. Thank you very much. Right. Yes. Yes, you.
Oh, me. Okay. Yes. I'd like to hear you respond to a couple arguments. I support your position, but I've heard some good arguments that go on the other side. One argument is that we can't really get rid of our missiles because any physicist now worth his salt can tell you how to make one, and any large industrial country can make their own, and they'd have them and we wouldn't. And the other argument is, the other argument is, sorry, I forgot the other
one. Well, that's the first one, maybe you'll think of the other one. All right, why we can't get rid of our nuclear missiles and other warheads because it's too easy to make them now. Well, it is true that there's a problem of proliferation. In the course of time, the knowledge of how to make nuclear missiles and nuclear warheads has become very, very widely dispersed. There's a famous case of a graduate student at Princeton who wrote a thesis on how to build a nuclear weapon, nuclear warhead. And he got an A in the thesis, but then the thesis was promptly classified by the Department of Energy. But now it's widely in the literature, how to build a warhead. And even the much more difficult business of how to build a thermonuclear warhead, the mystery in that has disappeared too, partly as a result of my own efforts as a managing editor of the Progressive. I helped to publish a story that was widely denounced because it would help people build an H-bomb. The answer to the question is this. While we can never bottle up the knowledge, should never try to bottle up knowledge, what we can do is is alert ourselves to and stop the spending of the money. It takes, while it's true that one can make a crude nuclear warhead in a sophisticated laboratory now, if you spend enough effort, it's possible for, say, a group to do that if it has a fair amount of money and know-how. It is impossible for a government to build usable nuclear warheads in any number without spending an awful lot of money. I'm talking about billions and billions of dollars. And furthermore, it's impossible for a government or even a large group to do this in any kind of scale without it being discovered through various techniques of radiation detection, surveillance, and so forth. Building an enrichment factory to enrich the uranium. An enrichment plant is a very, very big operation. Nobody can get away with building an enrichment plant clandestinely. So we can very safely, unilaterally get rid of virtually all of our nuclear warheads without fear that we are somehow going to be left naked in the face of of another power suddenly emerging having a lot of nuclear warheads. So the great danger to us now in 1990 is not from the remote hypothetical possibility that 10 years from now a Gaddafi or a Idi Amin will come up with a warhead. The real danger is that we ourselves, as a matter of policy or accident, will use our own warheads in fulfillment of our own policy. I mean, that is the danger to the world. Yes.
When you were describing the research that created these maps, mm-hmm. which I think is an excellent idea as a way of communicating with the people of the United States just how extensive the problem is.
Yes.
It occurred to me, because you had just previously read the comments of some of the neighbors to these sites, what you have done, besides bringing it to our attention, is to pinpoint these sites beautifully as targets for anyone who has missiles somewhere else and would like to neutralize ours.
Yes.
The neighbors must have terribly divided minds on this point. They certainly must have helped you to create the map, but what's their reaction to being zeroed in on as targets?
Yes. A good question. We wondered about that ourselves. Let me put it this way. These nuclear missile silos, all 1,000 of them, are virtually unknown to the vast majority of American people, where they are and what their specific locations are. However, there are two organizations that know very well exactly where they are. The Pentagon knows because the Pentagon built them. The other people who know exactly where they are is the Soviet Union. The reason is that the Soviet Union has a satellite system, as we do, which is looking at every one of these 1,000 missile silos every day. If somebody builds an outhouse next to a nuclear missile silo, they can spot that. And as a matter of fact, that happened several years ago when a contractor did put up a outhouse in a missile site next to a missile silo in North Dakota. They were doing some repairs. And the Soviet Union filed a complaint with the State Department saying, what's going on at missile silo K-19 in Montana? And you're doing something illegal. So, see, the Soviets already know. So we didn't have any military secrets. And once we made that point, at least we were able to at least relieve the true anxiety that the neighbors might have as to that. Nevertheless, of course, many neighbors did disapprove. And they disapproved not because they feared that they were going to be wiped out by the Soviets, because most of them have come to terms with that. What they disapproved of was talking about a forbidden subject, bringing up a taboo in local schools and particularly local churches. The churches in North Dakota do not like to talk about the subject, partly because many of the people in the crews who staff these silos are members of churches. And they don't want to raise an uncomfortable issue like that, nor do they want to disturb the peace and calm of their parishioners, who've got plenty to worry about anyway with the farm prices and the mess that our small towns are in. So it was that. It was the violation of the taboo that got us in real trouble with the neighbors. Yes?
I'm fascinated by the fact that they moved you around from place to place. I had a good friend who was in the West Virginia prison for theft of Bradford records for a year. And her experience was she got very close to the people who were there and really went through a terrible period of guilt when she was released. And I wondered if one of the reasons that they moved you from place to place was to prevent you from forming relationships with the people who are there for other reasons.
It was not that reason. It was a more specific reason than that. I decided early in my jail career that I would not cooperate. And so I refused to do prison labor. And that's a violation, that's a no-no in the federal system. And so when I refused to do prison labor, I was immediately arrested, locked up, put in a cage, and then just moved from prison to prison to prison during the remainder of my time. And it turned out, one would think that would be a pretty tough life. And while it wasn't the most pleasant life in the world, it also happened to serve my purpose, as it turned out, because it left me free to do my own labor. And if the truth be known, I worked harder in prison on that book and on other things than I have probably at any other time in my life. It really was a hard labor situation, but the kind of labor that I felt was important, and not the prison. So that's why they moved me around. Yes?
How do you feel now in terms of the disarmament situation? You talked about the Russians all know what we got, we know what they've got. How do you feel, say, in the last 6 months with what looks like to me, and I was skeptical to start with, but what looks like to me a genuine disarmament bilateral count? Getting rid of armaments. How do you feel about that? Do you think the silos will go, or what will go?
We're in a period of profound change, and it's worthy of a whole hour in itself just talking about that. I share your feeling of optimism that we are moving away from the precipice of nuclear oblivion, thanks not to our own efforts, but to the efforts of Mikhail Gorbachev and the Soviet Union and what's happening in the Eastern Bloc. We're benefiting from that. However, the Bush administration and the Pentagon are being dragged, kicking and screaming. The latest budget proposal of the administration for the Pentagon has just come out. They want a 2% increase for the next federal fiscal year. I mean, that's their idea of cutting back, is to increase by only 2%. And there's much we have to do in order to implement the possibility of de-escalation. Meanwhile, we're still producing nuclear warheads at the rate of 4 or 5 a day. It is true that these nuclear missile silos are going to come out. There's no question about that. There will be a START agreement signed in June. Everybody expects that. And these are the ones that are going to go, because they are obsolete. However, the problem is they're going to be replaced by mobile missiles. Things that move around on railroad tracks. And so that's hardly an improvement. We're getting rid of old, water-soaked holes in the ground that probably don't work anyway. And we're getting a more mechanized, more modern mobile system. We need to work on that. Just one final point. While the Cold War, the East-West Cold War, is settling down, we're getting together with the Soviets, the other war, and maybe the more important war, the North-South War, the war between the United States, the Japanese, the Europeans, and maybe also the Soviets on the one side, the Northern Hemisphere have nations, their war against the peoples of the Southern Hemisphere, the peoples of the tropical lands, their war against the Third World in order to preserve our privileged position of access to raw materials, that war is heating up. It's heating up in El Salvador, in Bolivia, in Peru, in Cuba. I had the good fortune to go to Cuba for a week last month. And there I was reminded of this terrible, quiet, cold war that we have been waging against Cuba for the last 31 years, and which may be on the verge of escalation now that Gorbachev has made a deal with Bush not to raise too much protest about what we're doing in the third world. So the situation is not just perfectly hunky-dory, but we need a problem. Let's see, there was some hands raised.
Just kind of a follow-up on that. I mean, you say that Mikhail Gorbachev, you know, is to be lauded for his efforts in getting, helping to rid the world of high-tech military hardware. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I wonder, you know, it gives him and Bush opportunity, as you say, to for us to do what we're doing in Panama, for the Russians to do preserve their oil supply in Azerbaijan by doing precisely what we did in Panama. And people are going to die, whether it's high-tech or low-tech military.
Azerbaijan and Panama. The Soviets may have oil in Azerbaijan, but I don't equate their dealing with the Azerbaijanis with our dealing with the Panamanians. I mean, after all, they didn't go beyond their borders and deliberately overthrow a regime. They didn't happen to agree with. They were confronted, the Soviets. Uh-huh. The Soviets did not invade a foreign country. They're putting down a rebellion. They're putting down ethnic warfare within their own regime.
Distinction without a difference, I think, Sam. I'm not sure that the Azerbaijanis really want to be part of the Soviet Union any more than the Panamanians want to be part of the American Empire. It's a paper difference, I think.
Yeah, but, well, you know, the Armenians would probably maybe have a little bit of a different view of that. Anyway, your point is well taken, that there's going to be more of a parallel economic or joint economic interest between the Soviets and the U.S. at the potential expense of people in the third world.
We will allow one more question because the children will have to be coming up very quickly.
Do you think there should be a separate political prisoner system in the United States, dissimilar or separate from the criminal, let's say, commission of other sorts of crimes?
I do not. I absolutely loathe that idea. Political prisoners are, well, I don't even call us political prisoners, but people who go to prison for breaking the law deserve to be there. They broke the law, and they should not escape punishment. They should not expect soft treatment simply because they chose to do it in a different way from others who break the laws for different reasons. We need to experience the injustice and the ugliness and the violence of the prison system. And the way to do that is to be a prisoner yourself. And that's one of the big benefits. We go in there as kind of lily-white peaceniks, properly concerned about nuclear oblivion, and we get to see the other side of the coin, which is the terrible injustice of our criminal justice system, the terrible ugliness and violence of prison. And when we emerge wiser people and we integrate the causes of peace and justice better. So I say put us in the worst of the dungeons and let us benefit from that experience.
Julie, in the nature of an announcement, I'm going to assume, what was your comment?
it was actually a question. I had two things. It's one about the failure rate of missiles. And I mean, one thing that we were talking about is the dangers of what happens when they fail exploding the ground as they get further out of the ground. Not all of them are going to reach their targets. Mm-hmm. So that was another danger. I guess I want to point it out. And the hope that you would stay after the service so that people had questions, that they could also chat with you.
I would love to stay.
Thank you very much.
Might as well get the recurring one out of the way as quickly as possible. Today is Prairie Fire Deadline Day, again.
This time also, it's the deadline for the monthly calendar for February. So if you're a committee chair and you have a meeting scheduled during February, please let me know when and where and what time that will be. Any other announcements? I would like to have them by 5 this evening, please, preferably before you go home. I have pens, I have paper.
Just one comment I wanted to make regarding Sam Day's reference to a bi-weekly club meeting.
We wondered how you got that new van.
And that is simply that Sam Day handled himself very well. Any further announcements?
Oh, you're doing announcements already?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd just like to draw your attention to a leaflet that I'm going to leave back there. I got a grant from the Wisconsin Humanities Committee to put together a 5-lecture series under the topic Black History, a Global Perspective. And I will be opening this series on February 15th, and after that there'll be 5 Thursdays. I'd just like to draw your attention to it, and I'll leave some leaflets and information over there. Okay?
John?
I'd like to remind people that it's coming Friday. It's video night here at 7:30, and we're showing a film that's a comedy but has some association with aging.
What's the title?
Where's Papa?
Oh, what is it?
Where's Papa?
Great comedy.
A couple of things. Passing the badge. Note from downstairs in the class. We have Kate Tucker and Pat Cawley are signed up to wash dishes today. And we have nobody signed up for next week, so I'm going to pass this around. We really need people to volunteer to do this activity. If you want coffee, we have to have people to wash up after this. And another thing is several of us are going to meet, I guess up on the stage maybe after the service to talk about getting some procedures, working out some procedures for the kitchen so it's not so chaotic as people make coffee or when they clean up afterwards, so that we know from one week to the next where things are and stuff like that.
I like the chaos.
Yeah, what? Easy for you to say if you don't make the coffee. No,
but I clean it all the time.
Yeah, the last thing is that I want to remind people that we're always interested in new members, and anyone who's been coming for a while, if you would happen to be perhaps interested in learning more about Membership Repair Society, you can see me. It's very simple. Very simple. I
can
sign the book.
So,
see me
and I'll just talk about it. Would like anybody who is visiting or a gift would like to introduce themselves, we'd be delighted to hear it.
My name is James Bank, and this is my wife, Deborah. We have 2 children. We live in Plateau, Wisconsin, and we usually attend the Dubuque because it's closer, but we'd like to Dubuque Unitarian Society, but we'd also like to be attending here as much as possible.
You're welcome.
Anybody else?
I'd like to introduce my niece, Janet, who's staying with us for a while while she's taking a respite from her studies at Northwestern University.
I see that the baby is growing very rapidly.
I have 2 friends I'd like to introduce. One is Denise Bowen, and the other is Natalie Brawl.
Great. Thank you. And at this time, we generally give an opportunity to anyone to share with us a joy that they've had, a good time, or for that matter, unfortunate time. And?
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure if it's a sorrow or a concern, but I think I mentioned a few months ago that one of my sisters is in the process of getting divorced, and the major reason for that was that her husband was beating up on their older son, and this child, they're only 16 years old now, but I observed him last Christmas, and he's really, just really, really full of anger at having gone through the situation found out last weekend that he started threatening his mother and has been placed in a residential mental facility for at least a month, which I hope that's all they have insurance for, and I hope that they can help him up enough in that amount of time. But we'll just keep our fingers crossed, because this kid really needs a lot of help, and I feel a little sad about it. But I don't want him threatening my sister, so that's kind of sad.
Fine. Is there Judy?
There's a social action committee meeting at my house February 8th at 11 o'clock.
February when?
8th.
Yeah. Anybody wishing to know the address, speak to Judy afterwards. Song number of week.
I have one more announcement.
Yes.
Okay. Next week, the topic is going to be the treaty rights issues about fishing and timber. I don't have a speaker yet, and we don't have a speaker. It'll be a do-it-yourself service with some readings and some role play and some discussion that I'm hoping still to get someone who can come in and share their knowledge. But that will be the theme for next week. And then the Sunday after that, Orange starts her lay ministry. Okay? And the final song is on page 25, Strangest Dream.
Thank you for coming.